Well, so let's say I got 60 screaming monkeys out of these four people. That's not all that big. Get them in memorandums and phone calls, etc. So I decide to lock myself in my office. And I'm going to do something about my problem. Well, I remember that my company sent me to a training program on problem solving for managers. And I was very much impressed with what the professor told us. He said, when you have a problem, you have got to write it down. Because if you can't write it down, it's a sure sign you don't know what it is. So I get my secretary on my squawk box and I tell her, I'm going to spend the rest of the afternoon by myself getting caught up. Therefore, I want privacy. I don't want to talk to anybody except you know who. I don't want to see anybody except you know who. I want privacy. Incidentally, who are the acceptors you know who's? First, your boss, that's right. So that makes it purely academic. And people in the system that you better see, right? So therefore, a shut door for a manager is a snare and a delusion to begin with. There is no such thing, really. So you say, I want privacy. Then she says, okay. And then she mutters under her breath, I can't understand how Mr. Unkin could even conceive he's enjoying privacy locked in an office with 60 screaming monkeys. That can't be privacy. But obviously, he knows better what he's doing than I do. So I sit there trying to figure out what my problem is. My 60 monkeys are already broken out of my monkey cage. They're chasing each other back and forth across the office floor. And I'm racking my brain. 2 hours later, it's now 3 o'clock, my secretary gets me in a squawk box. She says, Mr. Unkin, I think you ought to know that, and she names them, all these four guys are sitting outside your office, urgently wanting to see you before quitting time today. By the way, what do they want to see me about? Well, they want to see me about their monkeys. Hell, I got them all. They don't have any at all, right? If they're going to do a day's work, they got to get their monkeys back. That's what they're out there for. Of course, I don't know that. See, I don't know that. So I say to Mabel, will you please tell these gentlemen that while I am in a goldfish bowl all week, every week, I'm entitled to at least 3 or 4 hours once a week in privacy, and I'm sure that as considerate ladies and gentlemen, they will accord me that. She said, well, I'll try that. What have they been doing for the last 2 hours while they've been sitting out there? If I could overhear what they were saying about me behind my back, one would be saying to the other, pointing toward my shut door, bottleneck, Unkin. That man never could make a decision. How anybody ever got that high in this company without being able to make a decision, we'll never know. Just another example of how in our company, incompetence inevitably sinks to the top. Here I am working myself to the bone, 24 hours and all night besides, and they're calling me incompetent. There is no justice any longer in this world. I resent that. So I say to my secretary, please tell these gentlemen that I can't see them. I'm entitled to this time. She hangs up. And along around 4:45, it dawns on me what my problem is. What is the obvious solution to being behind? Why, get caught up. You see the magic of problem solving. Get caught up. It's now 4:45. Quitting time is 5. So I gather up my monkeys, put them back in my monkey cage, and to go home, I want to get a good night's rest so I can go back to the office over the weekend and get caught up on all this stuff. I'm about now to leave my office at 5 o'clock. To leave my office, I had to leave through the door of my office, down the hall. But this time, if I make that trip, I'll have to pass these four crows perched on that clothesline outside my office. And now let me ask you, in respect to these 60 monkeys that I've got, who's got the supervisory role? Anybody? They have. Who has the worker role? I have. And as I walk by, what are they going to do? They're going to exercise their supervisory responsibility. And as I walk by, they're going to say, hey, boss, how's it coming? That's called supervision and follow-up. I can't take it. I haven't got the gut, the stamina to take that treatment. So I avoid it by ripping up my sofa and tying the fabric into a knotted rope. I swing one end out the window, tie the other end to my desk leg, and I let myself down out that window, 3 stories, hand over hand like an escaping convict into the parking lot below, jump into my car and drive home. After a good night's sleep, I get up, and I get up from my breakfast table and head for the garage. My wife, sensing what I'm about to do, rushes after me across the rear lawn and says, "Bill, Bill, it's another weekend. Must life always be this way for us?" And I turn around and I say, "Honey, you know it's all for you and the kids." I jump in my car, drive to work. A lonely car, my car is, in that abandoned parking lot that Saturday morning. I enter the building. I can. I'm a wheel. I have a pass key. Down that first floor corridor I walk. Never before had my footsteps echo more loudly from one end of that abandoned building to the other, as they do this lonely Saturday morning. Up those stairs, down the hall. Never before did my briefcase weigh as heavily as it does now. I enter my office, and as I do, I lay my briefcase on my desk, snap open the lid to survey all I have to do, and then I lift up my eyes for just a moment to take in that beautiful view of that golf course that lies across the highway. And when I look at that golf course, whom do I spy on the out there teeing up? Him and him and him and him. Four of my people out there on the golf course. What kind of a thing have we got? Well, I'll tell you one thing, that does not turn me on. I can remember years ago, well, what is it? I got out of school in 1934. I got my first job. That was Depression years. Got my job right out of school. In those days, the best students got the jobs. The rest had to go on to graduate school. And I remember back there in the summer of 1934, there was many a weekend that I and my buddies were in the shop getting caught up, and we all knew where our bosses were. They were on the golf course, and that's how we fellows felt it should be, because that was how the American dream was explained to us. It gave us an incentive. It's now, what, 40 years later, I'm still in the shop. A whole new generation is on the golf course. I said, when did the American dream pass me by? What we've got here is me, a hard-working employee. And those guys out there, if I could reduce myself to a fly and buzz about their heads on the golf course, I would overhear one saying to the other, "Hey, fellas, things are looking up. Did you see whose car just pulled into the plant parking lot? It looks like the boss has finally decided to earn his money." Spoken like true executives about a hard-working employee, executives who have mastered the art of delegating work and the even more important art of follow-up and supervision. How's it coming? Do something for a change. When are we going to get some answers? And because I've got all their monkeys, meaning I've got all their next moves, they have no initiatives left to take. Therefore, they are frustrated. The definition of frustration is when you have lost all your options, you are frustrated. That's the definition. I got all our options, so they are becoming frustrated over the length of time that they've been working for me, increasingly so. And what about me? Well, I owe them 60 monkeys. Benjamin Franklin once said, the surest, quickest way to turn a friend into an enemy is to become indebted to him or her. That's why I recommended you don't borrow from your friends. I owe those people 60 screaming monkeys. I'll never be able to meet my payments. That's why I feel guilty. Every time I look at them, my guilt feelings are exacerbated. And so as I pick up monkeys, they get frustrateder and frustrateder. I feel guiltier and guiltier to the point where I even avoid them if I see them approaching me in the hallway, just as most of the rest of us tend to avoid a debtor if we're overdue, right? We don't want them to bring up the unpleasant business that we're not as good as our word. And so they've been getting frustrated and frustrated, me guiltier and guiltier, and we have been for several years like five drowning men in a death clutch in the middle of the management sea, carrying each other like five rocks down to management's Davy Jones's locker, and I still don't know what my problem is. Well, at that point, the clouds part. I'm looking out the window. The clouds part. And through a crack in the clouds, there descends a blithe spirit. bearing a magic wand with which he is about to touch my eyes to cause the scales to fall away so I can see what my problem really is. And when the scales fall away, I say, I see it now. I see it now. They're not working for me. I'm working for them. And then comes a revelation through the crack in the clouds, very much as Moses must have experienced one when God came down and explained to Moses what the problem really was. Only he came down with a statement of the problem in a set of tablets. And I then realized that if I do any of the things I came to the office this Saturday to do, my problem would only be made worse. Because as I mentioned, if I make his decisions for him and snap them off, what's going to happen to the frequency and the difficulty of the decisions he brings me in the future? They will go up. If I reward his memorandum writing neurosis by responding to all of it, I'll get him twice as many. They'll be twice as long and twice as complicated. The idea being that now that the boss is on the ball, don't hold him back. The more I do of what I came to do, the worse the situation would be. Or I now realize that that is now not my problem. That's why that cannot be the solution. Instead, I realize that the more I get caught up, the more I will fall behind. Now, you've heard that one before. It's bandied about, you know, half jokingly. You know, the harder I work, the behinder I get, and it's rather funny. But it's not funny for managers. For people who are not managers, the other 85%, that is the people who are paid for their time and labor. That doesn't mean they're necessarily all blue collar or clerical. Like, for example, if you only got one lawyer in the company, just one, he got to do all his own work, okay? Or an engineer that is designing and drafting, do his own work. So when I say that you're a doer, that doesn't necessarily mean where you're on the organization chart. But nevertheless, you remember some of you when you were engineers and you fell behind in your drawings? What did you do? You went to the office over the weekend to get caught up, and you were. That was a correct solution for anybody who's paid for their time and labor, or some of the others of you. Do you remember when you were in accounting and you got behind on balancing the books? What did you do? You went to the office over the weekend to get caught up, and you were. That's because you're paid for your time and labor as an accountant. But for those of us who are paid for our judgment and influence, then getting caught up only worsens the situation. Why? Whose work am I behind in? I'm behind in their work. I haven't been behind in my work in 15 years. Haven't got it started yet. When I see that, I've experienced a secular counterpart of a religious conversion. The whole world takes a whole new vision for me. I now decide that anything that I do that I came to do would make matters worse. Therefore, if there's any place I ought to be this weekend, this office is not it. I don't know where I'm supposed to be, but I know this ain't it. So I snap my briefcase shut again, and I run down the second floor corridor as fast as my legs will carry me. The weekend janitor, seeing me go by like a streak of lightning, says to me, "Mr. Unkin, where are you going in such a hurry?" And I tell him, "Get out of my way. My speed is not explained by where I'm going. It's explained by where I'm leaving from." Down those stairs I go, hitting every sixth step. I then jump into my car and I drive in a random direction of the compass as fast as the law will allow. And 15 minutes later, I'm in the outskirts of town. I don't know where I am. I don't know where I'm going. And I have no plans for the weekend. Let's cut the movie right here for a second and see what happened. My two questions. A half an hour ago when I arrived at the office, I had committed myself to putting in 2 full days of which kind of time? Subordinate imposed or discretionary? Which? Subordinate imposed. It is now a half an hour later. I don't know where I am, don't know where I'm going, and I got no plans for the weekend. I'm now confronted with 2 full days of which kind of time? Discretionary time. For 2 full days of subordinate imposed time to be converted into 2 full days of discretionary time in the short space of 30 minutes cannot be pulled off by the will of the flesh. That's why I invoked divine intervention, the blithe spirit. Ordinarily, most managers don't wise up to this for their first 15 years in management. That's how long it takes. But we got to be out of here at 4 o'clock and we can't wait 15 years. So I ask God to perform a miracle and make the conversion just like that. Now I got another problem. What do I do with my discretionary time? Never had any on a weekend before. and wouldn't know what to do with it. So I say to my blithe spirit, dear blithe spirit, you solved one problem, you gave me another one. What do I do on discretionary time on a weekend? She says, you get caught up on the other roles you play in life. You are a husband, a father, a neighbor, a citizen, and you ladies are wives and mothers, neighbors and citizens, et cetera, et cetera. She went down the whole list. She says, that's why you go to work, is to finance those other things. And if you don't pay attention to those other things, you'll never get back what you worked for. You get caught up on those things. I said to her, I make a U-turn. I head for home as fast as the law will allow to see if I can head the family off that Saturday morning before they go their several ways. I make it in the nick of time. Pull up in front of the house to a screeching halt. Holler out my car window. Say, hey, Ma, hey, kids, pick up what you need. We're going on that picnic. And they know which picnic I'm talking about. It's a very, very important picnic. It's the one that I have not had time to go with them on for 15 years. That's which one. And confused, they jump into the car. We go down to the county playground and spend all day at badminton and shuffleboard and volleyball and at all of the other pleasures provided by the town council for the poor people. That night we come home and we go to bed. And Sunday morning I go to church with my family, the first time I've been to church with my family in 15 years, on and off Sunday. And there are 49 of those in case you've lost track. Sunday afternoon, back to the playground. And on Sunday night, I go to bed early. And that night, I put in 10 hours of sweet, dreamless, untroubled slumber. So soundly do I sleep that twice during the night, my wife figured I was dead. She put a flashlight in my face to find out what was up. And then she saw a serene, angelic smile from ear to ear. What am I smiling at? I'll tell you what I'm smiling at. I have some very definite plans for Monday morning. That's what I'm smiling at. I'd never gone to bed on a Sunday night with a clearer idea in my head as to what Monday morning was going to be like than I have now. Next morning, I wake up refreshed. After breakfast, I head toward the garage. I can't remember the last time I made that short trip with a spring in my walk. I drive to work. Can't remember the last time I made that trip, whistling all the way. I enter the building, upstairs, and I head toward my office on the second floor. And as I do, I encounter a familiar sight. There, those four crows are already lined up waiting for me. Because they can't make another move, I got all the next moves. And it used to be that I would hate to run that gauntlet. Because they would always ask me, hey, Unkin, how about our budget? How about this? How about that? How about the other thing? It just made me sick. And that's why I used to hate these people, because I saw in these people for years a source of all my problems. They are, aren't they? They gave them to me. And there's a tendency to hate people who are the source of your problems. It's almost a constant of human nature. But now, since I've underwent my secular religious conversion, right, I'm a new person. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. And I now suddenly realize, to my astonishment, I don't hate these people. I don't at all. I feel an overwhelming love for them. Why do I love these people suddenly? I'll tell you why. Because I can see in each one of their backs a repository for several monkeys. That's why I love them. Look, only last Friday I saw these people as a source of all my problems. Now for the first time I see in these very same people the only available solution to these same problems. What a switch. And because I'm so overcome with love and I have a great difficulty in controlling my emotions, I'm afraid that if they perceive that I love them now, just that change in my behavior could cause them to go berserk. So I decide to deadpan it, not letting them know how I feel. So I decide to look neither to the right nor to the left and deadpan it all the way, but I'm a bad actor. They look up and they can see a cheery good morning inscribed in both my eyeballs. And that change in my behavior so takes them by surprise that they burp in chorus. I walk past them and into my office, and my secretary notices another change in my behavior. I did not shut my door behind me. The first time in 15 years I didn't shut it behind me, and that change in my behavior so takes her by surprise that she punctuates that chorus with a burp of her own. The whole place is upset, and I haven't said a word. Everybody in the front office now knows there's been a dynamic change in the leadership climate, and I haven't said a word. So I'm behind my desk, and I say through my open door, because these people are sitting out there waiting to see me, and I say to Mabel, who's first? She says, Jones is first. He got here at 6 o'clock in the morning to make sure that he was at the head of the line. So I say, send him in. Jones comes in. I sit down, Jones, what can I do for you? He said, Bill, he said, those truck drivers in Mobile, Alabama, they're still there. They're on another long-distance call. We told them to take a coffee break because you'd get back to them. They've been living on straight coffee now for 3 weeks. We've got to do something about it. And I say to him, Jonesy, you wouldn't believe this, but I'm a hell of a lot more broken up over all of this than you are. And he can't believe it. Especially since I got my feet up on my desk, very relaxed about the whole thing, while he's having conniption fits, and you can't blame him. So I fish in my pockets for these 8 or 9 backs of envelopes on which I've scribbled these problems, and I lay them on my desk under his chin, like a pile of confetti. He said, what's that? I said, don't you recognize them? Those are the 9 monkeys that I'm behind in doing something about. He said, what do you want me to do with them? And I say to him, well, you've got to admit that this is a rather unsightly pile. So the first thing I'd like you to do is to neaten it up. All right, notice this pause when I say that. To neaten up the pile. In our language of this seminar, what is that? It's a next move. It's a monkey. Is there any way that he could screw up badly enough on neatening up a pile that his career could be hanging in jeopardy? No. It's a very low-risk next move, right? The way to start shifting monkeys is to shift them on a very low-risk basis, both for the boss and the subordinate. This way, the guy is defenseless. Anybody who says that he's not competent or capable of neatening up a messy pile shouldn't be trusted loose on the streets for an hour. The reason why managers find it so difficult to delegate is that they delegate a whole ton of something, and the risk is enormous for both the boss and the subordinate. The name of the game is to shift the initiative. You do that before you delegate. I'm going to repeat that. Before you delegate, you transfer the initiative from yourself to the other person. Any initiative, regardless how trivial, is okay to make that shift. I'm a long ways from delegating yet. I'm getting ready for that. So he said, what do you mean, neaten it up? So I said, well, you got to admit, there's a messy pile. He said, well, I don't know what you mean. I said, well, now, look, maybe I can give you a little help on this. Why don't you get yourself 9 3x5 cards? Then you take one of these scraps of paper on which you will find written in my handwriting to myself a next move that needs to be made, transfer it onto one of those 3x5 cards, this time in your handwriting addressed to yourself. You do it on each of the other 8. Now you're going to have a neat stack of 9 3x5 cards, each with a statement of the next move, written to yourself in your own handwriting. What have I done? Shifted the initiative. Those next moves are now his to make, whatever they are, not mine. We can delegate maybe 3 or 4 weeks from now after he gets over the shock of having the initiative. And I say to him, now, once you've done that, I want you to deal those cards into 2 different piles. You have a copy of your own job description, and you probably have a copy of mine, and if you don't have it, you certainly have access to it. But by using our 2 job descriptions, you take a look at each one of those cards and ask yourself, based on our job descriptions, whose initiative is that, Mr. Unkin's or mine? And deal it in my pile if it's my initiative, in your pile if it's yours, based on the job descriptions. This follows a very important point about monkeys that goes this way. Every monkey has a home room. But now here's my question. If you're not sure of the home room of a lot of monkeys, on whose backs must those monkeys lie awaiting the verdict as to whose monkeys they are? Whose back shall they lie on? That is exactly right. So if you're not sure who owns the monkey, the first thing is put it on the subordinate's back so the monkey can await the verdict on the subordinate's back. If it should turn out that the monkey belongs to the subordinate, you don't have to give it to the subordinate. Leave it there. If it turns out that the monkey is yours, you can reach with deliberation and purpose and take the monkey and put it deliberately on your own back. But if you let the monkey sit on your back awaiting the verdict and half of those monkeys belong to a subordinate, then, as I said earlier, it's as painful to take a monkey off your back and put it on somebody else's as to tear adhesive plaster off a hairy leg. So any monkey that's up for grabs goes on a subordinate's back at the outset. Then we decide whose it is. On whom is the burden of proof in a conversation as to whose monkey that is? Is it on the boss or the subordinate? It has to be on a subordinate. So since the monkey's already laying on his back awaiting the verdict, all you got to do is tell the guy, if you believe that monkey belongs to me, convince me. If he's unable to convince you, where does the monkey now belong? On his back. That's why you don't have to persuade your subordinates of anything. You give them the full fair day in court, right? If they got a good reason why that monkey belongs to you, you are a responsible supervisor, I'm sure. You are not a shirker of responsibility. I'm positive of that. And if they got a good argument, you buy it, you pick up the monkey. If they haven't got one, you leave it right where it is. So then I say to him, once you got all of that done and you got the cards dealt into two piles, then you're ready to see me. When do you think you can be back with your cards dealt in piles? Well, he says, it's Monday now. With everything else I got to do, it's going to take me at least 2 days. I think that that's frightfully long. But everything is relative. If I were going to do it, how long would it take me? All together now, till hell freezes over, right? Okay, all right. So I'm getting a bargain even at 2 days, even though he's going slow as molasses. So I say, okay, you got it. I reach for my appointment calendar and write a note there for myself for Wednesday. Wednesday, 9 a.m., I write to myself, be here. Jones will show up with the piles. He grabs up that bunch of 9 little scraps of paper and walks out of my office. And as I see him go, the very thing I'm looking at causes the blood to surge up and down my backbone. It's rehabilitating my nervous system. Years are being taken off my life. I'm in euphoria. What am I looking at that's doing this to me? I'm looking at his back. There goes a back out of my office with the monkeys on it, screwed squarely between the shoulder blades, out that door, down the hallway. Vengeance is sweet. What am I going to do first? Shift the what? Shift the initiative. Delegation is way down the pike, but you got to shift the initiative. And the rule is the initiative you pick has to be what? Low risk for both parties, requiring no skill, no background, no nothing. That's why they can't fight it back. They can't say, well, gee, I can't do that, or I haven't been trained for it, or any kind of that nonsense. And several times each day, just for kicks, I'll stick my head in his office and say, and I want you to say it to me in chorus now, how's it coming? How sweet it is. Thank you.